Meeting will come to order. We have a quorum. Representative Scalzi.
Mr. Chair, I would move to approve the minutes of January 29th.
Representative Scalzi moves the minutes of January 29th. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, motion carries and minutes are approved. Well, members, today we're spending the day looking at one of the budget balancing tools that the governor proposes, and that is the appropriation bond. And our committee has an interest in this because we want to ask the question, does it affect debt service guidelines? Does it affect our ability to pass traditional bonding bills? And what I'm hoping we can do is, as much as possible, use language understandable by me. the average person who can understand what is the tool, and so I'll use my own setup already, and when the department comes up, in fact, you can please do. As I looked at this and processed it in my own mind, I thought it appeared to me something like a family that realizes it cannot pay all of its bills this year, and so it makes a determination that the one that will be sacrificed and used in another way will be the mortgage payment. So the principal and interest for this year, we're going to go and get a second mortgage or a home equity line or something. Now, granted, I suspect the average person couldn't do that, but if they couldn't afford any of the dollars for their mortgage. But let's just say they say we're going to take out this second mortgage, and for this year, to solve our problem this year, that will pay for our principal and interest that we owe. The next year, we will again owe all that principal and interest, and we will owe the principal and interest on this new loan. And I think that's the tool we have in front of us, and that's the one we're sort of going to try to unpack. And members, there are a number of handouts in your folder, and the first two that I'd like to reference are the department sheets. They look like this. One is says at the top, Governor's Implementing Budget Recommendations, Tobacco Appropriations Bond. The other is the change item. It is page 5 and 6 of the governor's recommendation, and specifically speaks to this issue, because this is information previously given to you, and there are some things we might as well just clear the air about before we have the presentation of the department. And in the first paragraph, where you see the recommendation, the governor recommends the Commissioner of Management and Budget be directed to sell state appropriation bonds up to $1.085 billion. The end of that paragraph states, to meet state constitutional requirements and federal regulations for tax-exempt bonds, all proceeds from these bonds will be used directly for one-time non-operating costs. The net result of that bond, of that bill, is a $973 million decrease in general fund spending in fiscal 2010-2011. And perhaps the first thing, Ms. Cardell, if you could tell us, if we bond for 1.085, where do we get what it gives to us for the purpose of balancing the budget is $973 million.
Madam Chair, is this on? Can you hear this okay? Madam Chair, my name is Kathy Cardell, and I'm Assistant Commissioner for Treasury in Minnesota Management and Budget. The net number is reflective of the fact that we will have debt service due on these bonds during the next 2010-11 biennium. So you issue bonds, and yet you're going to have to make debt service payments that we're going to have to make out of the tobacco settlement receipts during that biennium. It's an estimate of that.
And so that would be for the $1.085 billion net bond sale, it nets $973 million.
And I'll stress it's an estimate.
Yes. And then the next one then is the budget recommendations that specifically talks about the tobacco appropriations bonds. And that is still out there, and I think you even referenced it in today's presentation. But I think there are some issues to clarify there as well in the first and second paragraphs of that page. The department says, to pay this debt, the state will use roughly one-half of current tobacco revenues during the next 20 years. And then this proposal adds the state's assurance that bond payments will be made regardless of what happens to tobacco revenues. And that is so that marketability and cost of that bond issue is not overly stressed, I guess. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, I think you talked about this, I think, very briefly last week during another hearing, but I would say that the word, use of the word assurance is perhaps a little bit of a misnomer, because these are appropriation-backed securities, as you'll see when we talk about the legal structure for this, and when we also talk with the bond council about it. It is certainly a much more creditworthy structure than a tobacco revenue bond or a tobacco securitization, which are other tools that could have been used in this case.
And my understanding then is the difference for our purposes, we're accustomed to general obligation bonds, which are public debt backed by full faith and credit of the state. In other words, if the bottom fell out of the general fund, the state would still say, then we're going to levy property taxes, but we are going to pay those deal bonds. And the difference in what you're proposing for the appropriation bond is they are not backed by full faith and credit of the state. And so if the bottom fell out of the general fund, then the bondholder would be left holding the bag.
Madam Chair, you are absolutely correct in your description of the obligations that we have under the general obligation bond issues. With respect to an appropriation credit, it is in fact just that, subject to appropriation in each fiscal period. However, I would tell the group that if there is a decision not to appropriate, whether for this obligation or any other obligations that we have, where we have made an appropriation-backed credit pledge, so to speak, that would have consequences that would also be very significant for the state's credit rating and also for our ability to access the market.
And as I understand, tobacco bonds are not necessarily marketable. Appropriation bonds are, but because of that different status, the cost is higher for the appropriation bond.
The cost is higher for an appropriation bond in comparison to a general obligation bond. That's correct. The cost between an appropriation bond and a tobacco securitization, well, as you point out, Madam Chair, it's not a marketable security in the current environment, and it's a very, very expensive proposition, even if it could be done.
And then, members, on that same page, at the end of it, under other considerations, the first paragraph says, one-time funds such as these are not a long-term solution to the state's current budget deficit, although payments for these bonds do not technically impact the state's 3% guidelines, they may count toward broader measures of state indebtedness used by rating agencies. And the department prepared for us, I believe this is yours, the schedule.
Yes.
Looks like this. And this will help you understand what is the, there will be two bond issues. And so you will see that starting in 2010 and for the next 20 years, the first column, the column on the left is the annual debt service. The column on the right is the biennial debt service. And so this, I think, is one of those first things that helps to show the impact on future bonding that our committee might have an interest in. And my understanding is that this would impact three of the five guidelines. It would not impact the 3%, but it would impact three of the five other debt service guidelines.
Madam Chair, I believe that's accurate, yes.
And then one more. And this is more questions, again, just to clarify before your presentation. The second paragraph, use of this tool will allow for the replenishment of part of the budget reserve. And there, I think my question is, does tax law allow this? And as we did some research, we saw, for example, the Colorado Center on Law and Policy said U.S. tax law requires the proceeds of such state tax-exempt bonds to be used only for deficits or capital construction. There is no assurance that the bonds would be considered legal if the proceeds are used for the rainy day fund. So maybe just to clarify that second paragraph.
Madam Chair, and I think we'll talk a little bit about how this might theoretically work structurally in the context of the presentation. As you'll see, the intent is to free up the what otherwise would be appropriated for fiscal year 2010 and 11 GO bond debt service obligations and use that money for other purposes, one of which could be replenishing a portion of the state's budget reserve account.
And that will come
in. So we're not using these proceeds directly for that purpose at all.
Okay. And then, members, this is, again, probably paper overkill, but in order to understand their presentation, it seemed to us that you should have some things in front of you. And the other thing you have in your packet is Standard & Poor's definition of measuring debt, that Standard & Poor's debt ratio calculations aggregate all tax-supported obligations, including GO bonds, appropriation obligations, special tax bonds such as sales, personal income, and gas tax. And the second paragraph has a sentence that I think would be helpful also for us to get some clarity. Bonds secured by tobacco settlement revenues are also excluded from state debt calculations if they conform to our stress scenarios and are payable exclusively from settlement revenues. But you're saying this appropriation bond is not going to be paid for by... So that would, if I read this, it would seem to suggest that this $1 billion would count toward our debt service.
Madam Chair, the rating agencies, and we can talk about this in more detail if you'd like when we get to the slide about credit considerations. The three rating agencies do not view the state appropriation credit that is intended to be paid from tobacco settlement receipts, although not pledged that source of repayment. The same way. S&P would look at a state appropriation bond that is intended to be repaid from tobacco settlement receipts, even though they are not pledged, as a self-supporting obligation that would be netted out of their calculation of our debt burden. The other two rating agencies do not follow the same practice.
So we'll proceed with your presentation.
Okay.
And that also is in your packets.
Mm-hmm. Let me to the next slide, please.
And welcome to the committee, not only Ms. Cardell, but the commissioner is here.
I was going to introduce Commissioner Tom Hansen, who is here to make sure I don't use words like vociferous, as I did last week.
I'm here to push the slide.
And also just introduce to you...
I was going to say good use of talent, but...
I told him that we can...
I could flip
that.
No, I walked into it, man.
Also, now he usually says we're very kind to him in this committee, so I shouldn't have done that.
No, you know, there's a lot worse you can say.
I also wanted to introduce representatives from the State Bond Council from Dorsey and Whitney. They'll be speaking to you a little bit here, but Len Rice and Lynette Slater-Crandall are partners at Dorsey, and my key right-hand counsel on all matters related to state debt.
And members, I'm going to suggest that you take in their whole presentation, and then we'll save lots of time for questions. So we'll ask you to move quickly and then uninterrupted, but then we'll open the floor for questions.
So let's start with the first slide, which addresses the legal authority for these bonds. As we've already talked a little bit about, this is an appropriation-backed credit. It is not a general obligation bond, which carries the full faith, credit, and taxing power of the state. Our Constitution says that obligations, and I put that word in quotes because that's literally what the Constitution says, are payable from taxes that are public debt. But appropriation-backed issues are not long-term debt. They are payable in each fiscal period as current expenses. And again, as we've talked about, the intended source of repayment is a portion of the annual tobacco settlement receipts, which I've abbreviated for brevity's sake as TSRs going forward, but they are not legally pledged for the repayment of these obligations. The bonds are intended to be issued as tax-exempt obligations, and the proceeds of the bonds will be used for tax-exempt purposes under federal tax law. You'll see I've bolded the word preliminary in the next bullet. The preliminary expectation is that proceeds will be used to pay for the bulk of the 2010-11 biennial general fund debt service payments. The amount that otherwise would be appropriated for the 2010-11 biennial debt service would be available then for other uses, including funding a portion of a budget reserve. Let's talk a little bit about structure for a moment. The goal was to have annual debt service obligations not exceed 50% of projected TSRs. That mitigates risk to the general fund because, remember, these are appropriation-backed obligations in which any available funds could be used for that purpose of paying debt service. And just, again, as a reminder, the TSRs right now are about $200 million a year currently. It's projected to increase slightly. Very slightly each
and
year.
And I'm assuming TSR is tobacco sales revenue.
Tobacco settlement receipts.
Settlement.
That's my little acronym, so I don't have to repeat it over and over. Excuse me. The goal for the final maturity of these obligations is 20 years. And that's what you see reflected in the schedule that you've looked at here. But the actual maturity will be subject to a federal tax law analysis relating to the debt service obligations that we will be using the proceeds to pay for. If you want to go down the road of federal tax law, that's why we have Darcy here. The assumed slightly ascending debt service requirements to match, it says GII, that's Global Insight. Global Insight is actually the entity that prepares annually a cigarette consumption forecast that is widely used throughout the United States. The 40-70 rule that we talk about with respect to our debt guidelines for our general obligation bonds does not apply here. Our preliminary analysis, as the chair pointed out, assumes that two series of bonds are issued during the 2010-11 biennium. That is helpful in assisting in minimizing the amount of TSRs that are estimated to be needed for debt service during that same biennium. We've staggered the debt service a bit. And as you pointed out, the initial bond size estimate is $1.08 billion, generating the net proceeds. Actually, it's when we were tinkering with the sizes, it's 983 is the right net amount. But I want to caution you all that this will change. This is going to be, just like any other bond issue, that is subject to interest rate conditions at the time of sale.
The higher the interest rate, the less we will net.
It depends on how it's structured, because we could say we will sell bonds to up to 50%, well, I don't want to say 50%, but we could sell bonds to net out a certain amount of dollars, regardless of rate. We could sell bonds that commit to a certain maximum amount of appropriation. And both of those will have a different impact on what you net out. But literally, you could run these numbers every week, every day, and they will be different. Talk about credit issues. the use of an appropriation backed structure is a significantly stronger credit than a standalone tobacco financing. It has lower financing costs and much broader investor interest. We touched on the comments by S&P, and I'll just reiterate that the rating agencies are not consistent in their approach to these types of obligations, and quite honestly, they're very frank about admitting that. S&P would rate it as a state appropriation credit, but they would net it out of their calculation of our debt burden because they view these as self-supporting obligations payable from non-tax revenues. Fitch and Moody's take a different approach, and incidentally, none of this is published. This is not published criteria. This is their conversations. Fitch rates it as a state appropriation without regard to the intended source of repayment. Under our current rating, they basically would rate it a AA with a negative outlook. The obligation is not netted out of the state debt burden calculation. Moody's is similar. They're not willing to say, because they don't have quite the same, perhaps, standard practice of assigning a specific notch down from the state's GL rating, but it's a very similar approach, it sounds like, than Fitch. But in any event, the second bullet point there is important because the rating is clearly related to the state's general obligation bond rating. Our prior appropriation-backed debt has been rated AA2 by Moody's and AA+. That's the most recent issue that we did, which was for the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension Facility in the city of Bemidji. That was issued back in September. Maintenance of a strong general obligation rating is important to the successful offering of appropriation-backed debt. The city of Bemidji sold refunding bonds in September to reduce the debt service payments for the state's Bureau of Criminal Apprehension building that we are leasing from them and paying rent on. It's an appropriation credit, the same as the Port Authority bonds for the ag and human services, health, etc. As with any obligation, there are risks. One of the risks that is probably the one that concerns me the most is that market access could become difficult again. I mean, there literally was a period in the fall where people were not buying municipal obligations. That is always, now, at least in my mind, that's always a risk, because we just don't know what the status is going to be of our credit markets going forward. A second risk is that,
and just to restate that, in other words, if you sold them in October and found you couldn't sell them, then our budget would be out of balance and we obviously would have to come back. That's the risk?
Let's say we could sell a bond issue later this year, but for some reason the market stopped functioning again in 2010. And we couldn't get the second issue done. I think to me that would almost be more problematic. So you correct me if you disagree with that, but that would be in the latter half of the biennium. So that could be problematic if that happened.
Madam Chair, we see from forecast to forecast variations of risk on any kind of budgeting we do, be it the collections of revenues or costs in the human services program, and this would be no different. There's risks in everything we do looking out over a two-year period.
Okay. The second risk is that our general obligation ratings are reduced, which would result in a lower rating on an appropriation bond. That would, certainly in the current market, result in a higher cost of funds and potentially fewer proceeds being able to be generated. And a third risk, even though we're not pledging tobacco settlement receipts to pay these bonds, if they are significantly less than forecast, you remember, we're talking about something that's structured to try to be less than 50%, so that's probably a pretty outside chance. But there's always a chance that you would have other general fund resources that might have to be called upon for appropriating debt service if those dollars did not materialize as we were anticipating. I wanted to talk for just a couple minutes about the experience of other states, because I do want to make the point that this is a tool that has been used fairly broadly around the country. 17 states have utilized some type of tax-exempt and or taxable borrowing using tobacco settlement receipts as a source of repayment. I want to emphasize that these are not all people like the state of California, who are clearly struggling with budgetary issues, but places like Virginia and Oregon and others. So it's a fairly broad universe of states. Four states have used some form of appropriation enhancement in addition to their use of the tobacco settlement receipts. I've listed those four states. They're California and New York. Their law actually authorizes them to utilize a specific percentage of their tobacco settlement receipts with a backstop of, in the event that those dollars are insufficient, that they would consider appropriating from any other available source. Oregon and North Dakota are a little bit different. Oregon really did a pure appropriation credit close to what we're proposing to do here. And so they're basically, we're saying we're going to repay this from any available source. North Dakota identified tobacco settlement receipts and a couple other little pots of money, but all of those also subject to appropriation. So they each use kind of a slightly different enhancement, but using primarily their tobacco settlement receipts as the source of repayment. And then lastly, how have other states used the proceeds? The first bullet point talks about capital, whether for capital projects directly, capital grants, refunding capital debt obligations, including debt service on tax-exempt bonds issued for capital. This is really the area in which we focused on. Certain states have used it for working capital purposes. There is a wide and complicated array of federal tax law that relates to financing working capital. I am not your best party to address that, but the folks from Dorsey can help us with that. Some states have also created endowments for various purposes. And again, there is quite an array of tax issues associated with doing that. But as I put in bold, each of these uses requires substantial tax analysis by bond counsel in order to ensure tax-exempt status of bonds issued. Again, it's our intent to issue tax-exempt bonds. Many of these states issue both taxable and tax-exempt.
You're a slide on the experience of other states. Do you happen to know those four states that have used appropriation enhancements? Do any of them have AAA bond rating?
Maybe we can do an overlay. Members, you may recall.
California and New York clearly don't. Oregon has, I don't know the rating of those particular bonds. They did them back in 2003. I believe they have ratings in the AA category, as does North Dakota. North Dakota doesn't issue general obligation debt. They are constitutionally prohibited from that. So all of the obligations that they issue are appropriation-backed.
Mr. Goldberg has a question.
Ma'am. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Tadell. When you appeared before the Ways and Means Committee, I think we asked a question that was troubling, I think, at the time. And in our other times, we've also met with the Department of Finance or Management and Budget. I think that you stated that the Ways and Means that, if I was paraphrased, that you lost the battle of the words and continue to use tobacco when there's no tobacco relationship here at all. It's an appropriation, it's a general fund. And I think I asked the question then, you know, if we continue to use the word tobacco, will it at some point jeopardize the sale of them or scare people off? I believe your answer at the time said, no, that the bond issues themselves will not ever say tobacco. They say appropriation. Am I correct in your answer?
Representative Stolberg and Madam Chair, I believe what I said was that any authorizing legislation would not reference tobacco settlement receipts. We would not intend to pledge any of that.
Well, Madam Chair, I guess that's the question. And if we're not going to pledge it, then let's not use it. But hope it's a general fund appropriation, period. And we continue to use it as tobacco and say, well, that's just the tobacco money. We can do that because it's not. It's general fund money that's being paid. Let me just ask a couple of other questions, if I may.
Yes, Representative Hilbert. We're in the question stage now.
Okay. In your budget documents, and I think you have it here as well, you state that we will be having a reduction in payments of about $938 million in the next biennium. So in your other budget documents, you also say this is an expense that is the expenditures are being reduced. Are you not going to pay for the bond issue in the next 2 years?
Yes, Cardell.
Madam Chair, Representative Stolberg, the bond issue that we're talking about here is amortized over a longer period.
No, Madam Chair, let me interrupt. The bonds that are currently due and the interest that's due in the next 2 years, is the state not going to pay that obligation?
No.
Madam Chair, Representative Stolberg, are you asking are we going to be paying debt service in 12 and 13?
I'm asking in 10 and 11, fiscal years 10 and 11, is the state not planning to pay the debt service and the interest that's due on the bonds that we've already issued?
We are using the proceeds
of these bonds.
Of these bonds.
So then how can you have that as an expenditure decrease?
Because the debt service obligations for the general obligation bonds is almost $1 billion.
Right.
And the debt service obligations projected for these obligations in the current or in the upcoming 2010-11 is $109 million.
Well, Madam Chair, my point is, it's not a decrease in expenditures. We're going to pay the bonds.
Right.
I hope we pay the bonds. So there's no decrease in expenditure, even though your document says you're decreasing the expenditure by $1 billion, and that's part of the governor's message is that we're decreasing expenditures. You're not decreasing expenditures, you're getting revenue of $1 billion. Additional revenues to pay the expenditures. So I'm glad that we're not decreasing the expenditures. And I hope that we are at least straightforward in saying that this is an increase in revenue, not a decrease in expenditures, because that's important.
Okay.
If we look at decreasing in expenditures, we'd say that we're not paying off the obligation. We are. We're using a different source of money to pay off the obligation. Mm-hmm. It's an increase in revenue.
And members, that's the one we referenced earlier. It's on page 5, this one, that's the change item, where they say the net result is a $973 million decrease in general fund spending. Your point is, we're going to spend that much.
Yes.
We just have a revenue stream to pay it.
Madam Chair, Representative Goldberg, I think in my presentation to your committee last Wednesday night, I thought we were very clear at classifying the proceeds of the appropriation bonds as other resources, and we tried to be as upfront as possible and put it where you could see it. So,
Madam Chair, Commissioner Hanson, you were very upfront forward, but I wanted to make it crystal clear in this committee as well. Thank you.
Words matter.
From these
have you finished your questions?
Well, I will have some later on, but we'll let someone else do this now.
Representative Junkie.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, my first question kind of was answered, but I want to bring it up again because I, too, was at the Ways and Means and Finance meeting. And as I listened and watched, I mean, almost every one of your panels mentions tobacco or TSRs. And Commissioner Hanson, that's just general fund money, right? I mean, where's the tobacco? Let me ask a question. Where's tobacco money go to date?
Chair, Representative Junkie, you can call it what you want. Okay. I'll tell you where we got the idea. It started with tobacco securitization. We realized we couldn't do it. We actually, a week before the governor's budget rolled out, well, should we call it appropriation bonds or tobacco appropriation bonds? And somebody said, well, maybe we should put tobacco in because we talked about it and show the linear thinking of where the idea. We can call it whatever you're comfortable calling it.
So, Madam Chair, the question was, where does the tobacco money go today? The $200 million we collect annually.
Madam Chair and Representative Johnson, it's a non-dedicated, non-taxed resource to the general fund.
So it's a general fund collection.
Absolutely.
So, again, I would suggest we quit calling it tobacco. It's a general fund appropriation. I mean, yeah, we can say it's any other general fund appropriation. You're right, Commissioner Hansen. So I thought at that time you were going to take the whiteout out and white out your presentations and things and your budget book so that we're just talking about it's a general fund obligation. It has nothing to do with tobacco, although, you know, politically in my area, talking about tobacco is a good deal because less than 20% of people smoke. So who cares? Use tobacco stuff. You know, that's how it goes. Now, my other question is, I think I've finally focused on what we're doing here. And it's, again, government like a business. Basically, my way of looking at it is what we're doing is getting an operating loan. Businesses get operating loans all the time. We have expenses we have to pay out of our business. I'm an appraiser. I run my own small business. If I can't meet those expenses, I get an operating loan. So clearly, that's what we're doing is getting an operating loan. However, what's troubling about this operating loan is the 20-year payback time. Most businesses, when they get the operating loan, will pay them back within the year or 2 years at an outside, which again then brings up my question. Suppose, there's no supposing, when the economy turns around a year, 2 years, 5 years from now, can I pay back my operating loan without penalty? Or do I have to go out and pay $1.6 billion for my $983 million debt? I mean, that's a substantial penalty to pay, or can I prepay it in a year or two when I get my money and my business turns around?
Manager Chair, Representative Junkie, one of the things that we would like to be able to have the ability to do is structure this so that we can repay these obligations early. Now, the question will be how early, because there are market penalties attached to a very rapid repayment. For example, when we sell general obligation bonds of the state that we amortize over 20 years, we generally leave those bonds to be non-callable for the first 10 years, and then we can pay them off without penalty after that 10th year. In this case, we would, if I could structure it my ideal way, you know, we would have something more aggressive than that, and then the question would be, what's the trade-off between an interest rate penalty associated with having more flexibility versus a little bit longer call period. Does that address?
It's getting there.
Madam Chair, if I could just follow up, sure. Representative Junkie, it would be our intent, you know, currently in statute, once we have a surplus, we pay back the budget reserve, then we pay back the shift. It would be our intent to pay this back, you know, in that order and then pay these back. We look at it as a one-time budgeting tool in extraordinary times. It is, and as you mentioned your whiteout earlier, go ahead and white out the $900-plus million dollars and then figure out whether you want to raise an additional $900 million taxes or cut an additional $900 out of programs. We liked those solutions less than this.
And Madam Chair,
in other words, Representative Duncan, what I heard them say is, yes, they could be paid off early, but it may increase the interest rate.
Right. So, Madam Chair, my question is, 1997, Representative Genius traveled with Representative Leader, I think, was there, and Malnau at the time, and Workman, and a bunch of us traveled and looked at rail systems around the country, Indiana, Chicago, Dallas, Texas. One of the things that struck me with Dallas, Texas, was when they did their debt service on their rail system down there, they just let 5-year bonds, and then paid them back, and then let another series, and then another series, and another series. So they never got stretched out to that 20 or 30 year type situation. If you're looking to prepay and you're looking to that type of a structure, not knowing yet if you can get that or realize it, why wouldn't we just issue a 5-year for now for our operating loan? And then if we can't repay it then, obviously we go back to the bank and we do another 5-year. Why would we not just do shorter periods of time instead of extending it out and then hoping we can prepay without penalty, et cetera, et cetera?
Madam Chair, Representative Duncan, I'd be happy to look at a shorter repayment term. The trade-off for that is simply that that will create a larger hole in the general fund because you have to use, you know, a higher amount of debt service to pay a shorter term loan to net out the same amount of proceeds if you're looking at the same general level of proceeds.
I'm done for now, but I know Thoburg's got a follow-up.
Just to follow up to that, at the present time, you're borrowing to pay the debt service as well. I mean, you're borrowing to pay the interest of the debt service, to the new debt service.
Yes, pardon. Madam Chair, Representative Thoburg, I hear your point. I guess what you understand. There's nothing magic about the 20-year term. It was simply trying to utilize, sorry, I'm going to say the word, tobacco receipts, you know, trying to minimize the use of those dollars.
I was just going to say, Representative Junkie, we'll take a look at that.
Representative Wagenius. Oh, okay. Well, right this minute, I don't see any more questions, so I think... Oh, Representative Silver.
I have a few more. You may proceed. You have identified three bond payments that you're using this for. The general obligation bond payments, the university football stadium, and the bioscience. And you indicated also that we are using general fund obligations for many other things as well, and you mentioned the Bemidji one, and we are using an appropriation type thing for the ag building and the health building. Did you consider borrowing to pay those off as well?
Madam Chairman and Representative Silbert, the use of those, you're right, there are several other potential sources. We haven't vetted those as well with Dorsey and Whitney as we did the others. I mean, let's just say that we didn't do an exhaustive tax analysis on this at this point. We were just comfortable with what we were looking at currently. There may be even other non-operating uses that we've just not identified.
And Representative Silberg, they will be at the table, so you might want
to... Some of the other resources or other things might be school bonds. Maximum amount of school bonds. I don't know what, but that cost us. There may be some other ones, park direct bonds that we are paying that may have. And how about just leases to the building?
Yeah.
Can we borrow to pay off our lease?
I'll let Dorothy talk about that because we haven't gone down to that level of detail. I mean, one of the really easy things for us to do would have been if as a state we did a lot of pay-as-you-go capital funding, that would have been a very clean and very easy use for these proceeds. But we don't. We borrow for almost all of our capital projects.
We did at one time.
And we have in the past. That's
but
right.
But we ended up borrowing to pay so we can give us a check back.
And Representative Silver, I'm going to put you on the list for the bond council because it sounds like this. Did you have further, Representative Silver?
No, that's it.
Okay. And Representative, I'm sorry. Okay, I'll put you on. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Commissioner, I want to go back to the RIF, and we had a joint hearing that Wednesday night with Waking Finance. I raised the question of risk, and you gave essentially the same answer you did here today. But I'm still concerned about it, and I'm not totally sure I buy into your argument that, well, there's certain risk because tax revenue may drop. I think you're adding to the number of risk factors. In other words, you're stacking, and that was the point I was trying to make the other day, that we have one more risk factor with the budget that we no longer, that we don't currently have. And so that increases the probability in my view, that something could go wrong. And if you recall, my question was in part then, what would happen if we weren't able to sell the bonds? Because you indicated you were going to sell them in October. The legislature built a budget, the governor's agreed to it, signed into law, and then we attempt to issue the bonds in October, and we all know what the market's been lately. If they don't sell, where are we at that point? And just kind of keep in mind the stacking of risk is increasing the probability. But if you could comment on that. But you seem to not accept the risk factor in the same way that I do, apparently.
Is that Mr.?
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, 17 other states have done this. I think that as a matter of course, you know, what the events that would happen, we would probably try and sell these bonds sometime this summer or early fall. And if for some reason they didn't, we would probably think about by the November forecast whether we need to make an adjustment in the forecast or not as to whether we think we're going to sell them or not, and probably consult with you and others in the legislature. So it would, you know, whether it is or not would be reflected in the November forecast, I would presume.
Chair, I know you've referenced other times 17 other states have done that. I don't recall if I asked or if you told us when they did that, you know, if they did it before the markets were as volatile as they have been of late or not. I don't expect that you might have that information. Now, maybe you do.
If you do. Otherwise, I mean, this does seem to me, particularly for the question that we're asking, what is it going to do to our credit rating with the agencies and therefore our ability to do traditional bonding? I had just made a note to myself that we would do some follow-up on that screen, but you may have some additional information.
Madam Chair and Representative Carlson, in terms of what other states have done, with the exception of North Dakota and Oregon, they have all been true tobacco securitizations, not the appropriation type of credit. The last obligations were sold in the summer of 2008, the securitized obligations. There have been appropriation credits that have been sold. In fact, the Indiana Finance Authority just did a large general fund appropriation issue last week. But so those types of credits are definitely in the market. And as I said, you know, we sold, granted, a small little financing for the BCA building in Bemidji last fall. So the securitization, nothing is happening in that market since last summer. On the appropriation front, bonds continue to be issued, albeit kind of herky-jerky, not in a fashion that we are used to.
Representative Carlson.
Any states, I mentioned 17 are successfully sold. Are there any states that were not successful?
Madam Chair and Representative Carlson, you know, I'm not sure that I have the information if there was a state that authorized this but was unable to do it. Wisconsin is, they sold a securitized financing that they would now like to refinance as an appropriation credit and presumably pull more money out of it for their budget purposes. They've selected professionals to help them with that. They have not done that yet.
Okay. Paulson. Final comment, you know, when we reference the building, you know, if bonds didn't sell, the construction on the building wouldn't take place. So there really comes at some degree we're going to be occupied on the building. But we're talking here now about building a significant part of the state's operating budget off of the sale of bonds. And that's why I'm perking up when I see you identify certain risk factors, and I'm saying that the risk is maybe greater than what you're feeling it is or what the information is, but I'll stop there.
And members, we had a number of articles on that whole issue of securitization. We only included several of them just to give you a flavor for how states were responding, but in the case of Illinois, calling the plan irresponsible fiscal policy and a dangerous precedent. The state comptroller urged the governor to veto legislation that allows the state to borrow against future tobacco settlement proceeds and use them to pay for current operations of state government. In the case of Colorado, their Center on Law and Policy issued a 10 reasons why securitization should be defeated. In the case of, I think there was some discussion about Wisconsin and Washington State. We've included a couple of them in your packet, but clearly there's some discussion about states that have tried the securitization, and we have some sense of that. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of my colleagues here just said that words matter, and that's true because we're trying to talk to Minnesotans and be honest with Minnesotans about what's going on. And I heard you use the words increased revenue, and that's troubling to me because what we are doing is we are increasing our debt. And we are increasing our debt to pay current operating expenses. And this debt will be paid off by my grandchildren. So my question is, has the state of Minnesota ever done this before? Not short-term debt, but long-term debt that will be paid off by the next generation for current operating expenses.
Ms. Yeah.
And Madam Chair, Representative Wagenius, not that I'm aware of. I would turn around and, yeah, not that we are aware of. So this would be a first.
And I think our staff looked at some of that too, and I think the chart I saw suggested they couldn't quite fill in that that block on this chart. Representative Wagenius.
No, this is a major change in public policy to have the next generation pay for current operating expenses of this state. So we throw all these big words around, which I could hardly pronounce, that's basically what's happening. We're making a big public policy change and telling future kids that they're going to have to pay out the debt we incurred today. And so I think we need to keep that foremost in our mind. That's what we're doing. It's a major policy change.
Madam Chair, just a quick response. Representative Wagenius, what we're telling the citizens of Minnesota is we're not going to increase your taxes by an additional $900 million, nor are we going to cut some specific program $900 million. So that, to me, is the issue. And I think I said earlier that we look at this as a budget tool to help us in difficult times. I don't envision us paying this 20 years down the road. I envision us paying this back after we pay the budget reserve, after we pay the school shift, and then we pay this back.
I think you triggered response in Representative Wagenius.
I figured I would.
You did. The money to pay this, all the interest on these bonds, will be paid by taxpayers. So to say that we're not increasing the cost to taxpayers, say we're not raising a tax, it's simply wrong. We, by doing this, are raising a tax to be paid for by future generations.
Representative Riccovina.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. My shoulders slump,
Representative. First of all, members, and Commissioner Hanson, it's good to see that the governor has actually kind of agreed with me in that he's saying that we need revenue.
We need some revenue to get out of it.
But I think it's shameful that we're sitting here today even discussing this proposal. You know, there is no way, first of all, I mean, to get $1 billion today, you're going to pay $1.6 billion over 20 years. And not even to get $1 billion, but, you know, I recall Governor Pawlenty a few years ago calling the Senate, an honest attempt by the Senate to raise revenue, profoundly stupid. And I don't know if this is incredibly profoundly stupid or what's beyond profound. Because this is really a stupid idea. you know, and the citizens of the state have to realize that,
Madam Chair,
that this in no way has got the floor right now.
To that point.
I think Representative Riccovina, he's suggesting, I suppose,
calling a plan incredibly stupid, I think, is not for the decorum of this fine committee.
I think
Mr.
you were.
Chair, Representative Davis, I quoted the governor.
I think that exact statement.
Representative Davis, I think that was his point. He was quoting.
The Senate of this state raised an idea to raise money. He called it profoundly stupid.
And I would recommend him, too.
Yes.
Good.
Representative Riccovina, please continue.
He's no bonding project for you.
You are. You're profoundly fair. But this $1 billion is one-time money and has nothing to do with addressing what we have as a structural deficit in this state for years to come. And I heard former Representative Goodnow and former Finance Commissioner Kudrowski, I think it is, talk about that situation. And I know that the governor, you know, in 2003 talked about the King Kong of budget deficits. And this got to be the Godzilla, I guess, of budget deficits this year. But the honesty here is that there are taxes being raised, and there is revenue being raised, but it's only being raised, in this instance, one time. And then being paid just to get $1 billion fixed right now, it's like that, you know, that addict. Got to get that fixed and then worry about the consequences later. And, you know, I don't think this is really Governor Puente's economic philosophy, because, I'm quoting what he said about a month and a half, 2 months ago. Albert Einstein famously defined insanity as doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result. Americans don't need a Nobel Prize winner to understand we can solve a crisis caused by the reckless issuance of debt by then recklessly issuing even more debt. Remarkably, we have now entered the second or third round of bailouts for some companies and industries. But bailing out the bailouts is like using credit cards to pay off credit cards. It's a strategy that would have even made Charles Ponzi blush. So this is exactly what the governor was talking about in December 8th. So what changed from December 8th to now that he would do exactly what he said in this little political article that he sent to the future of the GOP that he said he wouldn't do on December 8th. What's the change?
Commissioner, I think I heard you answer that earlier by saying that he, to balance the budget, he did this instead of raise taxes and instead of cut an additional program. To raise taxes. Did I say cut? He did this instead of raising taxes or cutting an additional program.
Yeah. I was trying to figure out. I always thought King Kong beat Godzilla, Representative Riccovina. So I don't know about that analogy. I think I said it earlier in this committee. I think Representative Riccovina, it's an extraordinary time in which we see people who are people losing their jobs, and it's not the time to push another $900 million. Plus off onto the people of Minnesota. And that's why this is a good budget tool for now in these times.
But Mr. Senator, you're pushing $600 million off on the people over 20 years just to get a six month. And so you're raising, there's a tax increase. You know, members, if I remember my history well, since Governor Puente took office, and in 2001, when some of us at this table were here and we went into a special session, and government almost shut down that year, but it didn't that year. We got out of here, we cut a deal on June 28th or something, and then Majority Leader Roger Moe said publicly that this is going to cause the structural imbalance. With the school takeover and the tax bill in 2001, with about $1 billion of obligation between the school takeover and the fact that levy takeover engineered by Ken, Representative Mackle. And it was said publicly that this was going to happen. And think about it. We have had a deficit in 2002, a deficit, the King Connor deficit, in fact, in 2003, a deficit in 2004. I think getting rid of inflation, which was the Enron accounting practice agreed to by both then Majority Leader Valente and Moe, taking that out, we probably would have had a deficit in 2005. I think we had a deficit in 2000. Which year did we go to the and actually go into July? Was that 2005?
Yes.
Okay, right. So we had a deficit that year. We had a deficit in 2006. 2000, or maybe not 2006.
No, we were plus.
2007, we had a little bit of money to spend. And 2008 to 2009, it was terrible. We're at the Godzilla, King Kong's wife, sister, brother, and whoever. So the point being, members, again, Representative Davis, glad to have you back. You're here to help out. None of us are getting out of here without raising some revenue, and the governor has proved my point with this proposal. It's just, who's going to be honest about it? Where are we going to actually get the money and raise some money again to solve what we have and are facing in this state? Is a structural deficit forever if we don't solve it now? So, Commissioner, you're a good man, and if you earn every $108,000 penny of that $108,000 you get, there's a little more now. I don't remember, but you know, it's not your fault, and you're doing a job you got to do. But please relay to the governor that we got to do something here, because we can't have 5 or 6 deficits in 7 or 8 years around here. Something's wrong. Something's terribly wrong.
I have Ripson, Scalzi, Davids, and Howes, and then I think we'll have bond counsel up, because that's one other piece that we want to be sure we get to. Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the first overhead that we saw, we talked about legal authority, and I'm just kind of curious, from 2005, and I do remember that year, it was my first year as a legislator, and we set down government because we didn't have enough revenue, so to get out of that session, we raised the cigarette tax. And I'm wondering why didn't we do this in 2005? And the second part of that question would be, do current laws allow this? And maybe you can enlighten me on that.
Ms. Cardell.
Madam Chair, Representative Scalzi, I'm going to defer to the Commissioner on the 2005 question, since I don't know the answer. I was not here. On the say the second question again. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
The current law. This would require a special authority. We would have to draft legislation that would authorize the issuance of these obligations.
Carried by Rukovina, Madam Chair.
did you follow?
I was just curious why we didn't do this in 2005.
Oh,
Commissioner Hanson.
But
Commissioner, I don't know if you're able to answer that one.
I was here. Madam Chair, Representative Scalzi, I don't think we had the rapidly declining revenue and the ever-increasing job losses early in mid-2005 that we see now, and it necessitates extraordinary measures like we're doing.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. You know, I left in 2006. We had a $2.3 billion surplus. I come back in 2 years, and what can you say? But, you know, it's interesting. What I generally said, and I didn't say it this time, but generally after the governor makes his budget proposal, which by Constitution he is supposed to do, and he's done here, what I generally do is I take it and I put it in the recycling bin, because I'm an avid environmentalist and I want to, you know, recycle those resources, because that's really about what it's worth. And I really don't see any difference at this point. If you are constitutionalist, you realize that it's the House that has to come forward with a spending program. So I don't, not that this is a waste of time by any means, because I always like to hear from Mr. Hanson, he's a fine gentleman, as Representative Rukovina said, but the governor's done his job, he's made his proposals, and at what point, Madam Chair, do we get on with it and we do our job? I can only think of when I hear people criticizing the governor's plan, is where's our plan? Where's the House's plan? I'm not saying Republican, Democrat, it's the House's job now to come forward with a plan. The question is, where's our plan? And when will our plan be? I mean, we can talk about the governor's proposals all day long, but what's the point? I mean, and he, you know, it's the starting point. He's done his job. He has to present it. But I want to know what we're going to do and when we can get on with it.
And Representative David, fortunately, this committee is probably the only committee that doesn't have to weigh in on that at all, because we have a slightly different function. But our purpose today, I think, was, and I think bond council will help us again with this, is to determine what is the tool and will it affect bond rating, ability to do traditional bonding. So in this committee, we don't write a part of the traditional budget. So, Representative House.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And with all due respect, and I don't want to get Representative Rukavina going, but I have to make a couple of comments, so, because we have a fundamental difference of opinion. You could say that this is revenue, you can say this is an increase in tax, but I'd rather say we're borrowing money to stall the taking of money from the citizens of Minnesota. Now, I've heard a lot of people talk, and I don't want to get Representative Silver going either, but, you know, Commissioner Hansen said we had extraordinary times. They call for extraordinary measures. This may not be the right measure, but at least it's an idea that the governor's put forward. We don't have to like it. I'm not totally thrilled with it, but it's a starting point. It certainly, by all means, is a whole lot better what they're doing in Washington over the last few months, and probably today, talking about the what might be the $1.2 trillion stimulus package, that if that's not tax increases, and we're just going to call it a revenue stream, I think we're fooling somebody. It's still money that belongs to the people at some point that we have to furnish government with. So whether we borrow to stall the taking, i.e. taxes, and hopefully in 2 years we will have a better a balance sheet, our revenues will increase without raising the taxes, we'll be able to pay this off. Maybe not, as Representative Carlson said, there's risk. Yeah, there are risks. There's risks just running for election to come down here and get paid $31,000 to make these tough decisions. But I think it's I agree with a lot of Representative Rukavina says, but it's all in how you look at it. Is the glass full or half full or half empty? And right now I'm hoping it's half full and we can make this work.
I think we'll have the bond council. Oh, I'm sorry, was there one more? Oh, Representative Mahoney.
Madam Chair, and My friend, Mr. House, Representative House, you know, I've spent the last 2 months going over policy on economic development and bioscience, and end up talking to one economist after another. They don't really see a recovery when the job's coming back until sometime early 2010. So I don't think the premise of more jobs coming in 2010 to meet this obligation is realistic thinking, so I have misgivings about it.
Don't run away yet.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any further? Representative Rukavina, I think. Representative Rukavina.
Come on back and get his blood pressure going.
You missed the whole point, I think, what I was trying to say. We have been in a structural deficit around here for the last 7 years, basically. We had a surplus one year. We still haven't paid for the 2001 school levy table and transit levy table. We haven't paid.
Madam Chair, can I correct Representative Rukavina? After the 2007 session, we actually had $1 billion. Representative Solberg remembers this. We actually had a structurally covered. It was about $1.1 billion in the tails that actually covered inflation. So we had it once.
And
you know, with the structure.
1 year. Out of how many years then?
I think Representative Rukavina granted us 1 year.
Oh, I was.
But we have a huge problem to solve. The medicine house, we can't wait for, you know, even if the recovery comes, Representative Holden, we still have to address the structural deficit in this way back in 2001 tax bill that we never paid for. And I didn't say that. Harney Carlson said it, and I just somehow have misplaced that with my legislative agenda, that quote. Forever than we have been known by the end of this.
It'll surely be in that front pocket by next week. I think we'll have the bond council come forward because one of the issues in this committee, of course, is how this debt is going to be considered and will it affect future capabilities for traditional bonding. And so if we could have, are both of you coming forward? Or
just Mr. Rice, Madam Chair, initially. This later, Crandall will run up and poke him if he says something inappropriate.
We are joined by Bond Counsel Len Rice from the Dorsey Law Firm. And I should just for the for members and audience, it's probably helpful to get a sense of you're from a law firm. Do you have a client relationship with finance or with the taxpayers of Minnesota who've been discussed around this table? I think just to get a sense of the legal advice you're getting us.
Madam Chair and members, I am Len Rice. I'm the head of the public finance group at the Dorsey Whitney firm in Minneapolis, and I'm the state's bond counsel, a job I've had for about 10 years. Technically, my client is MMB.
And just to sort of set the stage for this one to kind of transition, I had someone in my office either today or yesterday, I can't remember, who asked the question, which I think is on the minds of a lot of people, and that is, we've always known the difference between Washington and the states, and that is the states have to have a balanced budget, and Washington can run a deficit, and Washington can spend more than they take in, but we've always assumed that we can't borrow money to balance our budget. And so, I mean, in a sense, that's some of what we're struggling with. And members, you do have the letter in your packet, and because you probably haven't had a chance to read it, if you would just briefly talk about it, and specifically on page 2, where you talk about comparisons with some of the other debts, because we haven't gotten a sense yet of does this add to the debt that's going that rating agencies are going to look at and thus make it harder for us to get good bond ratings and good bond sales?
Sure. Madam Chair, the purpose of the letter was just to explain what the legal analysis is for this kind of financing. As has been made clear, we haven't done appropriation-backed bonding before, although we've issued a fair amount of appropriation-backed obligations of other sorts. The question was asked whether or not there was legal authority right now to do this particular kind of financing, and I think the correct answer was given. Appropriation-backed bonding is outside the scope of what the Constitution controls, because the constitutional controls pertain to, quote, obligations, unquote, and this particular kind of financing isn't a legal obligation because it's subject to fiscal period rollover. But in addition to that, there is not, because we haven't done this before, there isn't currently a statute extant that would authorize us to do it, so we would need the legislature to pass that.
And that will be forthcoming from finance, that language?
Madam Chair, yes, we've been working with Dorsey on draft language. And it's not, I think as I said last week, it's not quite ready for prime time, but it's getting close.
But even though we haven't done this particular kind of non-appropriation bond before, we have done a fair amount of appropriation-backed financing of other sorts. And if you look at the letter at the bottom of the first page in the bullet points, you see reference to lease purchase equipment programs which the state undertakes. The Constitution doesn't authorize the issuance of general obligation bonds to finance equipment. It's just capital buildings, those kinds of things. And so what we've done in order to finance the equipment is a kind of installment contract which is subject to this annual appropriation concept. And so that's the first, really the first two bullet points that at the bottom of page 1 and rolling over to page 2. So the analysis is really exactly the same for federal tax purposes and for state law debt purposes.
Madam Chair?
Do you want to go through this first? Well, Representative Colbert had that earlier question. We might as well
Is this a moral obligation bond that what if the next legislature refuses to appropriate the money for this particular expenditure? Because in some of the other things that we have this obligation, the agriculture building, the health building, the BCA building, and the university and so forth, if we don't, the bondholder themselves, I think, is at risk. Now, we may never want to do that because it may ruin our rating, but who is, in the final analysis, who is legally holding the bag if the legislature fails to do this?
I think I kind of heard that. Holding the bag, it's obviously a legal term.
Well, it is. It's around this table.
Yeah.
We all know what it means.
Absolutely.
It's defined in law.
But let's just go back for a minute to the difference between this and a general obligation bond, okay? If we issue general obligation bonds, the state pledges its full face and credit to the payment of those bonds. Mm-hmm. That means if World War III broke out and the state somehow defaulted mm-hmm. in its obligation to repay a bondholder, that bondholder could go to court and would win and would get an order compelling the state of Minnesota to levy taxes without any limitation as to rate or amount to pay that bond.
And that's a GO bond.
That is a general, a GO bond is a general obligation. That's a pledge of the full faith and credit and ad valorem taxing powers of this state to pay that bond. So in that instance, the bondholder definitely isn't holding the bag. Okay? This is different. In an appropriation-backed bond scenario, the contract between the state and the purchaser is that the state presently thinks it's going to pay back the borrowing. It presently expects that it's going to pay back the borrowing, but the state retains the legal right in a future fiscal year to not appropriate funds to pay the borrowing. If that happens, although as you say, that undoubtedly would ruin the credit rating of the state, that's not a, that's a consequence of what happened, but that's not a, a legal effect. The legal effect is that you haven't breached the contract, because that was part of the original deal. So the bondholder is holding the bag.
Well, and then that same thing, as I understand it, would be with the case, I don't know about the BCA and Bemidji. In that particular case, it may be the Bemidji City government that's holding the bag. I don't know that for sure, assuming. And I think in the University of Minnesota, the football field, it's a bondholder, because there's at least no legal requirement that the university pick up what the state doesn't pay. We said we would pay, but I don't think that, I don't know how that's structured, but I like your answer. In effect, it ends up to be what I would call a moral obligation bond, because we're probably morally going to do it because of this long-term effect if we don't in the state.
The term moral obligation
right.
bond is actually a term of art
right.
in the public finance business.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, I think when we looked, we couldn't find a moral obligation bond, right?
Madam Chair, actually the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency has a moral obligation pledge on their bonds from way back at the beginning. But
Representative Wiginia.
Madam Chair, I understand the legal argument you're making, and it's really hard for me to buy it. And we have these words in the Constitution that say public debt. And we can say that we're not legally obligated to do it, but there's more than a moral obligation to pay off that debt. It's a huge obligation. We would never be able to operate as a state again if we didn't pay off the debt. So it seems to me we're doing a little bit of a dance around the words of the Constitution. The court abhors the sham. And in this case, when I look at the premium to get one of these bonds, it's not much greater than the cost of a GO bond. So I think we're dancing. I mean, that's my sense of this whole thing that we're doing, is dancing around the words of the Minnesota Constitution.
All that I can do is speak to, you know, what the legal effect is of the governing principles, and as the letter says, legally, under the Constitution, this wouldn't meet the test for what is an obligation, that's as far as I can go with it.
Steve Mallory.
Sure. Mr. Rice, in your first page, you say payment of principal and interest in each fiscal year for which the bonds remain outstanding is a current expense for that fiscal period only. That seems to say that if we don't pay it some year, then it's just gone. I would have thought that if we don't pay it some year, that gets added into future interest and principal. But this says that it's gone, so... Is that true of this kind of a bond?
Mr. Rice.
The idea is in each fiscal period for which this obligation is rolled over, the analysis is that money that's owing in that fiscal period, since it's been appropriated, is a current expense and not debt. That is not to say that you can avoid paying it. I mean, if you are in a current fiscal year and you've appropriated the money to pay this bond and you don't pay, that's a default. And I think in that instance, an investor would be able to sue you for the money in that fiscal period, not for the future fiscal period, but for the money in that particular fiscal period, and would win.
Well, Madam Chair.
Mr. Mallory.
So if the debtor didn't sue, well, I'm not sure how you could sue in that fiscal period if you're saying that.
Well, let's say, for example,
if we didn't authorize it, we're saying that we're not responsible if we don't authorize it. So that adds a new issue. If you're saying now that if the legislature doesn't authorize it, somebody, the holder, can sue in that year and collect.
No.
Which seems to be the opposite of what you were saying before. And the second thing is, are you saying also what this statement says? It seems to be that if they don't get paid in a certain year, that it doesn't get added into what we owe in the future, which seems strange to me.
Mr. Rice.
Yeah, I think there's just a misunderstanding here of how this structure works. I mean, when you come up on a new fiscal period,
biennium,
a budget can have to be adopted with the money appropriated or not appropriated, as the legislature decides, to pay this bond in that biennium. If you choose not to appropriate, the deal's over. That's not a fault. That was part of the contract, and the investor's left holding the bag. The other alternative is you do appropriate the money. Now you're in the fiscal period, and for some reason the state doesn't pay. I don't know how that could happen, but if the state doesn't pay, in that instance, for the money that's owed in that fiscal period, you haven't non-appropriated, as we say. You did appropriate the money, you did roll the contract over, now you're in default for the money that you owe for that fiscal period. So investor would sue you and presumably would collect. Now, in terms of adding that to future fiscal years, obviously if this situation is deteriorated so badly, the following fiscal year the state's going to not appropriate anyway, so the thing would be terminated at that point anyway. So you're never going to have a stacking of fiscal years or fiscal periods where the state doesn't perform. But it would be possible to default within the context of one fiscal period.
That seems... First of all, then you'd say that if we appropriate and the governor unallots, then we can be sued as a state. But you're also saying that once we miss, we don't have an obligation in the future. That seems real strange.
Well, there's no doubt that it's strange.
And maybe that's the way these kinds of bonds are.
The unallotment concept is actually a good point, because that's part of this appropriation analysis. And so when we disclose to investors the ways in which the state might make a determination that it chooses not to go forward with the deal, the unallotment process would be part of that.
Right.
So it has to be. So that's the answer there.
Mr. Faded.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Mr. Rice, in 151 years of history in this great state, has the state ever defaulted on any type of bond?
No.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative
Solberg.
Let's follow up on that one. Did we come close one time to just about defaulting on some bonds called Zoo Ride and Ditch Bonds and a couple other things that in our history that probably causes some great deal of difficulties?
But the Zoo Ride is an interesting situation because that, of course, is an appropriation type of fact situation. So it's the Minnesota Supreme Court did say that the state did not have to appropriate the money.
Okay.
Madam Chair, culturally counts in horseshoes and hand grenades.
I'm just checking to see if Representative Solberg, were you...
Well, one of the things that is difficult for me is I think our Constitution, I'm not a constitutionalist, let alone a lawyer, but the Constitution says that we have to balance the budget in this particular biennium. And we can short-term borrow, as we've done in the past, but it has to be paid back in that biennium. And that's the thing that troubles me of this whole thing right now. That you're doing borrowing and not recognizing that our Constitution requires that borrowing be paid back in the biennium that it's being borrowed. It's an obligation to pay this biennium. We're borrowing for this biennium to get through this biennium, but we're not following the full Constitution. It may be a loophole. I understand it may be legal and all that, but we're not following the Constitution that says we have to, any borrowing we do has to be paid back in that biennium. And I think that, I'll go back to the history of Representative Carlson and Representative Murphy and others are more familiar with that, but that happened, I think, in the 3 years. And I recall, right, that if I came back, we still had 6 months to go in the biennium and we paid it back, that biennium. I think that is a constitutional obligation. And I think it may be legal, but we're pushing that, I think, a great deal.
Representative Davis.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And to that point, it's not legal now. What the governor's proposing, we can't do at this point. It would take special legislation to do that. So we're talking about some ideas. And I'm really excited and looking forward to what the legislature comes up with as an alternative to this.
Well, Madam Chair, that rhetoric is getting old. And it's not getting old. Representative Davis,
Chair, please.
To understand not only the legal ramifications of something, but the constitutional ramifications, and to be able to ask in a public hearing the legal counsel of what their opinion is of that is not, I don't think, getting old.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Rice, in your letter, on the second page of the letter, final paragraph, annual appropriation bonds are not public debt within the meaning of the Minnesota Constitution and are not subject to the same legal limitations. So as the bond counsel for the state of Minnesota, you disagree with Representative Solberg on his last comment?
My testimony is that this would be a legal bond issue, assuming that the enabling legislation is passed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Rice, I appreciate that and appreciate your work in coming down. I think this is a worthwhile debate for how we use bonds, and it's been a good learning experience to see that the different ways that we have purchased, sold, used bonds over the past. I think it's been the last week I've learned a lot about how we've done that. Obviously, it's not just for bricks and mortar that we've done that. We've made some difficult decisions. But I think that within the context of this budget, that there is going to be within the federal stimulus package one-time money for that is borrowed, that we are banking on both within this budget and on the federal budget, $900 million perhaps, upwards of $1.5 billion for things like MA matching money for things within the healthcare area, for things that are being debated that clearly are not long-term brick-and-mortar projects. potentially $3 billion in one-time stimulus, which will be, as Representative Lugenius aptly points out, paid for by our children and grandchildren. So I hope that we are just as, that we scrutinize the federal bill just as carefully as we're scrutinizing this very, by comparison, small appropriation.
And members, in your packet also are a set of questions and answers. The questions are from our fiscal analyst, and the answers are from finance. And the one that probably you don't recall, this one, the one was, how will this impact the bond rating, was the one I was going to reference right now. Is that correct? Is that the one you submitted to them? Oh, okay, sorry. I missed the reference.
I got any questions, and
my fault entirely. I misunderstood this. At any rate, the question on this sheet that we had somehow, I think, hoped to answer today, how will this impact the bond rating, which, of course, is ultimately what this committee is concerned about, and the answer was each bond rating agency will look at it differently. Some will include it in their calculations for state debt, and others will not. But that, I believe...
Madam Chair, I think that's accurate. Okay. You know, when I did speak with each rating agency, and, you know, they're never going to commit one way or another in a conversation like that when you're trying to understand their criteria for evaluating this type of obligation. But I think even, you know, Moody's in particular was very straightforward about saying, you know, there will be many factors that could affect the state's rating. It's unlikely that one single decision, whatever it might be, would be the one item that pushes that over. And I appreciated their candor on that, because they're right. I mean, debt ratings are a compilation of a lot of different factors, and this is certainly one of them.
And so for this committee, clearly we'll just have to watch as the session. There's another committee coming in. Representative Carlson has the last question.
Well, thank you. Mr. Wright, a citizen came into your office and wanted to sue based on the constitutional requirements of a balanced budget and asked the probability of success, asked you the probability of success. What would your answer be?
Mr. Wright.
When bond counsel approves financings for the state of Minnesota, we have to issue a written legal opinion. And there's a standard promulgated by the National Association of Bond Lawyers that governs the basis for our giving that opinion. And the reason for that standard is that the opinion isn't given as an advocate, because to do that wouldn't give comfort to investors in the marketplace. They wouldn't know where the client may be. They wouldn't know what standards and what basis the lawyer was making the argument. The opinion standard currently for bond counsel is this: we can't issue an approving opinion on this appropriation-backed bond unless we are firmly convinced that the highest court of competent jurisdiction, being fully briefed and acting reasonably, would reach the conclusion of the opinion. What that distills down to is we have to be very sure that we think we're right, because if you waver on it, that gives no comfort to the marketplace. So the answer to your question is they lose. Well, we think they're going to lose.
I raised that question. I remember a number of years ago being involved with the discussion, and some financial, constitutional-related issues came up, and I remember counsel that worked for the Senate at the time commented that they couldn't guarantee that some citizen someplace in Minnesota couldn't possibly bring a lawsuit. And that's what I was referencing. It seems to me that could conceivably happen, and I understand your role as responsible, but that could conceivably happen. I'm still kind of back on the risk factors of all of this, and could a citizen bring an action, perhaps?
And then, of course, I was talking about stacking of RIFs earlier in terms of what the operating budget. But thank you.
Thank you. And what we will probably do is continue to watch the conversation about this, and when it has to do with debt management, we will perhaps just always communicate and see if we can determine what does it affect and how does it affect the traditional work of this committee. Members, it's a lot of information. We have certainly not resolved everything in this day, but the next meeting, we're back in the basement, and we are getting a bonding update from MnDOT and the Metropolitan Council. Meeting is adjourned.